morning to introduce our first speaker, Professor Rob Nixon. Nixon is Rachel Carson, Professor of English and Creative Writing at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the author of London Calling, V.S. Naipaul, Postcolonial Mandarin, from Oxford University Press, Homeland, Harlem and Hollywood, South African Culture and the World Beyond, from Routledge, Dreamlands, The Natural History of Fantasy, from Picador. His book, Slow Violence and the Environmentalism of the Poor, will appear from Harvard University Press in May 2011. Professor Nixon is a frequent contributor to the New York Times, and his writing has also appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, The London Review of Books, The Nation, The Village Voice, and elsewhere. He has been a recipient of a Guggenheim, an NEH, a Fulbright, and a MacArthur Foundation International Peace and Security Fellowship. Please join me in welcoming Professor Nixon.
In Hanif Qureshi's wonderful coming-of-age novel, The Buddha of Suburbia, Karim, the hero, makes his way from suburban Kent, eventually all the way to New York. And at his first New York loft party, he's so exhilarated by the sheer diversity of the people around him. And he said, "Tonight I met a hairdresser from Wisconsin. How exotic is that?" Okay. "I'm not a hairdresser. As you can tell, I'm only an honorary cheesehead, and I didn't bring the outfit. But I have had the honor of teaching at a wonderful university, the University of Wisconsin, for 10 years now. It's, among other things, a wonderful place to teach the environmental humanities. And I feel extraordinarily proud and exhilarated to be part of the local energies of Wisconsin and the global connections that the students and workers and members from across the community have been generating. Just as a small example of this, there's a place in the center of Madison called Ian's Pizza, which at the end of the semester I always order a pizza for my class. And they have stopped taking regular orders altogether, and Ian's only takes orders to feed the protesters. But through PayPal, they are taking orders from around the world, from Morocco, from Egypt, from Tunisia. People are feeding the protesters globally, but with low carbon miles, carbon loading without carbon miles, if you like. And I noticed there was actually somebody from Kent, so I like to think this was somebody related to Kalim from Kent, remembering the Wisconsin hairdressers and firefighters and everybody else who's out there. Thank you so much for inviting me, and I feel honored to be here. And thank you to Jorge and Ellen and everybody, particularly for the way that you have formulated this conference. In such a way as to include both reconceptualizations of the field, which have their own value and integrity, but also, and particularly pertinent to the material I'm going to be talking about today, you've included questions about the role of environmental public intellectuals and artists in terms of affiliation with social movements, not least social movements among the poor in the global south and elsewhere, and also the representational challenges and the forms of ingenuity that such artists and intellectuals have generated. So the focus of my talk today is what I call slow violence and its impact on negative impact on the poor, and also the generative responses that have emerged from these social movements and artists and intellectuals. What I call slow violence is in some sense a counterintuitive notion. We typically think of violence as spectacular, instantaneous, as event-focused. And what I'm interested in is forms of incremental violence that are attritional, slow-moving, often difficult to observe, maybe because they're transnational or because they're occurring at a cellular level. I mean, the scale of slow violence is, the variation of the scale is enormous. So attritional, slow-moving violence is exponential and also often operates as a threat multiplier. In other words, it fuels conflicts or it contributes to the fueling of conflicts. So just to think of examples like, in the broadest terms, climate change, the thawing cryosphere, deforestation, the toxic aftermaths of war, biomagnification, toxic drift, and so forth. Okay. And at the back of my mind are at least three thinkers. One of them, Rachel Carson, when she talked in such innovative and rhetorically creative ways about what she called death by indirection, oblique deaths, discounted casualties. And if we think even of say, something like the way that the Vietnam War is portrayed, bookended between certain dates, the recent New York Times editorial said Americans were complicit in the deaths of 1.5 million people during this war. If we think about it in terms of areas like Bien Ho, where Agent Orange was most widely used, there's intergenerational deaths that get discounted by that sort of temporal framing. And so that's the kind of slow violence that I'm thinking of, where through biomagnification, through intergenerational passage of risk, you have invisible casualties, both geographically and temporally invisible. So Carson is one thinker that I have in mind. Also very much in terms of the role of the public intellectual, Edward Said, and who talked at one point about what he called the normalized quiet of unseen power, and I think that is a phrase has a particular pertinence to the hushed havoc and injurious invisibility that so often attends environmental slow violence. And then the third figure at the back of this is Johan Galtung and his theory of structural violence going back to the early late 60s and early 70s. And one of the things that was so innovative about Galtung was his insistence that there were these large structures that had profoundly violent effects that were invisible. Where I'm trying to take that in a slightly different direction is, while I'm interested in these impersonal structures of violence, I'm also very much interested in change and time, and the degree to which time is available or time is mobilized by anti-environmental forces, by forces opposed to justice, as a kind of camouflage. And we're used to talking about neoliberalism as systemically a way of internalizing profits and externalizing costs. And typically we think of that in geographical terms. In terms of globalization, we think about internalizing of profits and offshore costs. In other words, the risks become invisible because they're moved offshore. But I want to think about that internalizing and externalizing in temporal terms as well. That the externalizing of risk is an intergenerational externalizing as well through these toxic displacements. And one of the great challenges in representing and opposing slow violence is that we live in a culture dominated by speed. And I think this is obviously far more acute than, say, in the time when Galton was developing his theories of structural violence. So we live in an age where speed is its own self-propulsive ethic. And so part of the challenges, I think, in this particular moment of digital connection but also digital distraction is how to accommodate our degraded attention spans to questions of environmental degradation, the fallout from which is long-term. Okay. Other challenges involve the speed of the news cycle and the speed of the electoral cycle. As we can see, when there's a recession, often environmental issues are first out because they don't have the immediacy or they're not good campaigning material in terms of delivering for constituents within a 2-year or 4-year cycle. Okay, so those are some of the challenges of slow violence. I wanted to move to this first image, which some of you may recognize as Ken Sarawiwa, who was executed by the Abacha regime in 1995 as an environmental and minority rights activist for the Ogoni people in the Niger Delta area. And so Sarawiwa was writing in his films, his essays, and his fiction and poetry. He was working against the compounded invisibility of these micro-minority Delta people facing off against Shell and Chevron and against the authoritarian regime that was in cahoots with them. Okay, so we have this collaboration between sort of almost unbounded power of the petro despots in Nigeria in this period and unanswerable transnational corporations working together. And in the mobilization of this movement, Sarawiwa became an epic figure. Now, in terms of what I've been saying about slow violence, one of the features of the so-called discovery and resource richness of oil in the Niger Delta, which dates back to 1958, is that the Niger Delta has suffered oil spillages on the scale of the Exxon Valdez every year for 50 years. Okay. So this isn't one explosive event, but it has been an attritional drip of an extraordinary scale. Okay. So trying to dramatize and mobilize around an awareness of that and its long-term ecological repercussions was absolutely critical for Sarawiwa. Now, what interests me most about this mural is it's not in Nigeria. It's as those of you who can read Gaelic will instantly recognize, it's in the west of Ireland, County Mayo, a historically impoverished part of Ireland. And the artist there, a series of artists, created this mural as part of a larger effort to link the struggle against Shell in the west of Ireland with the struggle against Shell in the west of Africa. And what was going on, this was I think around 2005, was that Shell was coming in, building offshore platforms and also flaring. This project was to have an oil pipeline across a sensitive estuarine area on which people depended for their livelihood, and have gas flaring and so forth. Okay, so it was one of these examples of a kind of a local-to-local alliance that involved artists and activists against a common corporate foe, if you like. And the names at the top are the names of what is called the Ogoni Eight, the eight other activists who were executed alongside Sarah Weaver. And so I think this is an extraordinary example. And the Gaelic there is one of Sarah Weaver's poems translated into Gaelic. And some of the street names in Roscommon were changed to Ogoni names and so forth. Okay, so it's an extraordinary example of this kind of imaginative attempt to make links and to share information and share creativity across boundaries. I want to move on to a couple of other examples of slow violence. One of the things that is most concerning to me is the rise of the toxic aftermath of war in the era of so-called precision warfare, the era of cluster bombs, and in particular depleted uranium, which dates back to the Gulf War of 1991. And depleted uranium has, now that it's being incorporated into the battlefield, it's important to know that it has a radioactive half-life of 2.7 billion years. So if we're talking about internalizing benefits, whatever they may be, and externalizing costs, the long-term environmental costs are quite acute, and it poses both a chemical and a radiological threat. So here's what one of the colonels had to say about depleted uranium. "We feel we have to use depleted uranium. It's radioactive. I wish it wasn't, but I can't change the laws of physics. The issue is, once you've had a hit, once you've involved in the catastrophic failure of the tank, did the crew survive long enough to really care whether it was tungsten or depleted uranium that hit them? Anyone who does survive should count themselves damn lucky. I'm sure every soldier would thank God that he lived 40 years to contract lymphoma." Okay. So what you've got here is quite a, I would say, a fairly naked statement, acknowledging a two-speed lethality, okay? That if you're fortunate enough to survive an immediate war, who cares when you're 20? Whether 40 years down the line you're going to die of as a result of exposure to this slow violence. And of course what he doesn't address is the impact on the Iraqi civilians and the long-term impact on the water table and so forth. Okay, the legacy violence embedded into this kind of warfare. And it is very ironic that it's has emerged in an era where we talk about precision warfare, we talk about surgical strikes and so forth. And so what Carson calls death by indirection has radically increased alongside this orthodox discourse of precision. Now I want to turn to a different kind of example. Many of you may know the work of Wangari Maathai, who was one of the founders of the Greenbelt movement in Kenya, a writer and activist, who has worked with rural women in Kenya to oppose the slow violence of deforestation and soil erosion. And this is one of her remarks. "During the rainy season, thousands of tons of topsoil are eroded from Kenya's countryside by rivers and washed into the ocean and lakes. Additionally, soil is lost through wind erosion in areas where the land is devoid of vegetative cover. Losing topsoil should be considered analogous to losing territory to an invading enemy. And indeed, if any country were so threatened, it would mobilize all available resources, including a heavily armed military, to protect the priceless land. Unfortunately, the loss of soil through these elements has yet to be perceived with such urgency." And so what Wangari Maathai is doing here is she's trying to reconceive in her writings the idea of national security and what constitutes a threat, an invisible incremental threat that involves territorial seizure, that if it were perpetrated under conventional violence, would call for the mobilization of a national army in defense. Okay, and it's interesting that in elsewhere, like Vandana Shiva in her book Earth Democracy, comes up with similar formulations about what constitutes sustainable security. Now, I want to turn briefly to a very familiar example, which is that of the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe that began nearly a year ago. Okay, so these are the sort of the shocking cinematic images of the instantaneous violence at the Macondo oil rig. And there are different phases of visibility that this crisis went through. We had the images of the initial explosion, then we had the spill cam giving us access to the gushing. Okay, then the spill cam was shut down, the spigot was closed, and a certain phase of visibility was concluded. Just trying to stay with waves and undertows. Yeah. In this by now famous image, you see two substances. One, you see oil, and there's an orange substance there, which is the mixing of oil and Corexit. And as many of you know, something like 2.7 million gallons of Corexit was sprayed over the oil, ostensibly to disperse it. And as Anne McClintock noted in her reporting down at the Gulf, this was done primarily by planes and helicopters at night because of the sheer scale of the amount of Corexit that was used. And Corexit is banned in United Kingdom and Europe largely because of its renal repercussions. Okay. And so what happened, what Corexit was effectively doing, is another picture of the orange amalgam of oil and Corexit. After a while, this orange disappeared altogether. But what Corexit was doing was supposedly dispersing the oil, but it was regathering in vast plumes of miles and miles underneath the surface, invisibly, of the water. So what I see it as primarily is as an image emollient. In other words, the image of the oil spill was being dispersed, and that was affecting the kind of stories that could be told, or the dominant stories that could be told about the spill and its disappearance. And we, as we know from what Jorge was saying today, these images and stories get incorporated into legal stories as well. And so there are legal repercussions to the spraying of the oil slick with these image emollients. I want to move now to my final example, which is from the Maldives. And this was, the Maldives have lost most of group of islands in the Pacific, population about 400,000, and they have become increasingly eroded over recent years because of the dying off of the coral reefs as a result of the warming of the oceans. And the main island called Malé, what we have is they built a wall as a kind of replacement for inadequate replacement for the coral, degraded coral reefs, and this was during the tsunami a few years ago of the waves overwashing the coral reefs. Now, in 2009, just before the Copenhagen summit, the leaders of the Maldives got together with a group called 350.org. which many of you may know, which is an attempt to, by activists, artists, intellectuals, to mobilize internationally and creatively through digital connections and through actions on the ground against the rise of carbon emissions. And what is specifically interesting about the Maldives is that they are, the highest point is in the Maldives is 7 foot, about the height of Yao Ming. And they are about to be inundated. They're likely to become the first nation, 100% of whom become climate refugees. Okay. Now, when I say about, I'm talking about imminence in environmental terms, in terms of slow violence. I'm not talking about this electoral cycle. But they realized that matters were sufficiently urgent that they wanted to somehow surmount the invisibility of their problem, which was a temporal invisibility. Who cares what happens to these islands in, say, 50 years' time? A temporal invisibility and also a geographical and racial invisibility as a nation state from the global south and a very small one that has no visibility on the nation stage. So this is what they came up with, was a cabinet meeting, and I'm thinking of the Wisconsin senators crossing the line into Illinois. Here you've got the cabinet deciding to have a subaqueous meeting. This is drowning in paperwork, made literal, and we all sympathize with that. So they got their wetsuits and their oxygen masks on, and they're signing into law a commitment on the part of the nation state to become carbon neutral within 10 years. Okay. Now the Maldives are a very poor nation. I think per capita income is about 4,000 per head. But through this theater, which went viral in video and image form and also in narrative form, they connected up with a lot of other activists, and also it became a founding moment for a group of, I think, 42 island states that are threatened by inundation. And so here is Mohamed Nasheed, the Prime Minister, signing the document, and that's a Maldivian flag in the background, okay? And so I think of this in terms of a kind of a ghostly sea change that is being brought to life visually. And one of the things that's striking about me is just a year or two before this, there was another flag planted on the seabed, this time a seabed of the Arctic Circle by a Russian submarine. Claiming that underwater territory as Russian, okay, and that, as many of you know, sparked many other claims from Canada, United States, Denmark, and so forth, and other countries in the European Union, and there was a lot of militarized rhetoric, okay. And so when I think of these two flags, the Maldivian flag and the Russian flag, they seem very connected, almost, if excuse the pun, the carbon copies of each other. The flag of desperation at imminent inundation. The other, the flag that was the kind of starting gun for another race to the bottom. For carbon extraction and consumption by the colonial, historically colonial and imperial behemoths. So I read those flags in conjunction, and I read them in relation to what Walter Rodney many years ago talked about, the development of underdevelopment, and this is an undersea kind of example of that development and the resistance to slow violence. Thank you. Thank you.
just like to briefly introduce our respondent today. And it's David M. Hughes. Professor Hughes is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Human Ecology at Rutgers here. His work centers on the co-production of environmental ethics and of racial and other forms of identity. He has written two books, From Enslavement to Environmentalism, Politics on a Southern African Frontier, and Whiteness in Zimbabwe, Race, Landscape, and the Problem of Belonging. He now studies large emitters of carbon dioxide. This ethnography focuses on the oil and gas industry and complicit environmental movements in Trinidad and Tobago. And then afterwards, we will open it up for a question. All
right. Thank you for that introduction. I'm going to try to say five things about SLOW. I'll try to say them fairly quickly because I want to leave time for questions on what was a very provocative and textually rich and rich in images presentation. So what struck me first when I read some years ago Rob Nixon's concept of slow violence was I was a little bit frustrated with it because I thought that environmental movements were trying to establish the concept slow as a value. So you have the slow food movement and various forms of slow represented in walking and bicycling and so on. And so wanted just to pose to you this a set of oppositions between slow food and slow violence. So the ways in which slow has this kind of Janus-faced quality. You think of patience versus persistence, or a contemplative mood versus an excruciating mood, wisdom versus senescence, solid versus burdensome. And I think the example of depleted uranium crystallizes some of this, because militaries use they're looking for heavy materials now in order to break through heavy armor. And tungsten is heavy, depleted uranium is the heaviest thing you can manufacture or find. And that mass has a certain relationship to time, so that heavy things last, and the lethality of the heavy object when it's moving then becomes the lethality of the heavy object as it's slowly decaying. And also, of course, what we value most in our everyday technologies, our little gizmos that transmit, is the lightness of it. So there's two forms of modernity, let's say. There's the heavy, slow, excruciating form, which is something environmentalists oppose. And then there's the light, modern, the word for things that fit with your body, like keyboards.
Ergonomic.
Or the ergonomic lightness is another form of modernity. So I just wanted to think that the word slow has these various meanings, and it's interesting how it's being deployed in this presentation and in the slow food movement. My second comment on slow violence has to do with this notion of being dispersed in space and time, where something like an oil spill can be considered either as a point or as a field, and the difficulty of fighting against and mobilizing the imagination against violence of a field. I think we're at a particular historical juncture in the Atlantic world where we tend to focus on points more than we might otherwise. And that partly depends on distance and space and time. You know, New York, Los Angeles, the Black Death, and the Hundred Years' War, all are fields if you're close, but they're points if you look at them from far away. There's a wonderful display at the American Museum of Natural History, which it's a demographic map of the world over about 2,000 years, I think. Actually, it goes back much further. I think it goes back to early Homo sapiens. But every dot, every light bulb represents, 100,000 people or 10,000 or something, and the lights light up and the pattern changes every 50 years or every 100 years, I can't remember. And so you watch this and it takes, 10 minutes or so to run through the evolution of the human species. And if you watch it carefully and you watch Europe carefully, you will see Europe go dark in the 14th century. And it just happens in a flash, and then Europe lights up again. And so that's a remarkable way of converting something. The Black Death lasted 50 or 100 years, I think, but converting it into a moment based on distance. But also, I think the appreciation of points as fields or fields as points depends on one's degree of sedentism, dwelling, belonging, or longevity. So we're stuck a bit in a notion of bourgeois individuality and subjectivity where we compare the length of environmental disaster to the length of the human lifespan. And it need not be so. I think it's no accident that the unemployed, mostly unemployed royalty of Europe have gotten caught up in environmental campaigns because monarchy and lineage and so on it imagines itself as more enduring than the lifespan of any holder. And this may be, this also is a way of, I think, bringing the presentation across culturally because I remember when I did my fieldwork. First field work in Zimbabwe, there was a chiefly lineage that had been managing a sacred forest for at least 300 years and thought about this, thought about the incremental encroachment upon this forest as very serious and immediately calculated out what would happen if incremental processes were carried forward another four, five, six generations. So thinking in generational time then. Also, of course, this question of sedentism, this question of how you perceive fields and points depends on how one views one's own sedentism. And I think of some of the literature of the Black Atlantic, such as Derek Walcott or Edouard Glisson, who worked very hard to establish the Atlantic. So it's a large space, but establish it as a place, carrying meanings, charged morally in various ways, a kind of variegated sea and landscape. Which is not just empty and not vast, but has concentrates meaning. So this can be done. This can be done. One can imagine a field as a point, or vice versa. All right, and much of this also, to continue here on another point, this question of what you perceive as slow depends on your view of history. So in anthropology, my field, for example, we used to talk about contact, the arrival of Columbus and other Europeans in the New World as a moment, and now nobody talks about it as a moment. Everybody talks about it as a process. So in Brodel's terms, what used to be thought of as conjunctures are now thought of as the longue durée. And so that, is in a sense, is taking something fast. What we used to imagine as fast, and now we imagine it as slow. Right. So I think what I'm suggesting with those points is that one can't take slow for granted. It's culturally, speed, let's say, then, is culturally and historically constructed in various ways. Strategically, moving on to my last two points here, strategically, I think one can try to reconstruct things. One of the things I try to teach on is the way environmental movements represent climate change through images. And this has been a big problem. There was a photography contest that WWF Germany, I think, organized a number of years ago to try to take photographs of climate change. And it's hard because it's not dramatic. What they found is if you look at the thresholds, you can crystallize a process into a point, a process into a rupture. So, for example, Rob's picture of the waves breaking over the seawall in the Maldives, that is a rupture, right? Because if your island is at sea level, then a rise of only a few centimeters makes an enormous difference. It's a difference between everything and nothing, or the difference between zero and one. The same thing happens with ice melting. The difference between negative 0.5 degrees Celsius and positive 0.5 degrees Celsius is enormous. The difference between 30 and 31 is hardly measurable and noticeable in everyday life. So what a lot of activists have tried to do is turn temporal fields into temporal points, turn processes into ruptures, and to capture this through text and images. My final point is about the slowest violence. This is getting back a bit to depleted uranium. People talk about the Yucca Mountain issue, or the question of what to do with nuclear waste in the United States, the worst stuff being from weapons manufacturing. Talk about what to do with that, and there has been a plan, I'm sure many of you know, to stick it under a mountain on the Nevada-California border. That plan has been shelved because the site wasn't geologically suitable. But the Department of Energy said that the site would have to be protected for 10,000 years. And many people believe they should protect it for 100,000 years. But it's fascinating to imagine how to make a plan on that time scale, right? It busts through any kind of bureaucratic, text-based strategy of communication that we have. And they hired Thomas Sebeok, the semiotician. This was when the Department of Energy was a little more interdisciplinary and broad-minded. They hired him to come up with this keep-away sign that would last for 10,000 years. And they had some material scientists dealing with the question of what metal to use so it wouldn't rust and those kinds of questions. They just wanted him to write the message, keep away, in some way. So he considered all sorts of things like diagram. I mean, this was during the Cold War, of course, so everybody believed that civilization was going to break down entirely, and we'd have to rebuild ourselves for the Stone Age, losing language and losing books and losing everything. So he sort of did atomic diagrams, but then, of course, we might also lose physics because people wouldn't understand them. He tried, thought about Edvard Munch's painting, The Scream, but then, of course, that one is in a museum, and future people might confiscate the sign and take it to a museum. So that was no good. And finally, he decided, well, it wouldn't be a message, it would have to be an institution. And the institutions that last also, very coincidentally, tend to be the ones that perpetuate fear, so that's useful. And he thought about various Catholic churches and monasteries and said, we need a nuclear priesthood that will sit there and scare the shit out of people for 10,000 years about this sacred ground, this graveyard, whatever you want to call it. And then the Department of Energy fired him and never hired a semiotician again. So I don't know where that leads us, but those are my points on slow, and thank you, Rob, for a very stimulating presentation.
Yeah, I'll just make one, because I know we're short of time, I'll just make one quick point. Thank you, David, for those very stimulating and provocative remarks, which is that about a decade ago, as many of you know, Crutzen and others came up with the idea of the Anthropocene Age, in other words, the notion that the environmental changes wrought by Homo sapiens constitute are as consequential as a major geological event. And then later it was refined to talk about the Great Acceleration, which is roughly since 1950. So the Anthropocene Age is about roughly 200 years old, and then the Great Acceleration since 1950 in terms of carbon emissions and in terms of climate change. Now, there, I mean, it's another example of how do we define fast and slow. Geologists are a very particular community unto themselves when you talk to them about speed and slowness. 50 years for geologists is enormously rapid. Okay, and it's interesting to me in terms of what David was saying about these ruptures in processes and the attempt to render them in image and story. How, for instance, the slow violence of climate change has impacted our language. You don't talk anymore about a student making glacial progress. I mean, glacial is no longer a viable image for unacceptably slow progress. But it has become such a foregrounded image. I mean, for speed, ironically, for quickened loss, and so I think this is an interesting example of how this impacts language as well. But I don't want to talk anymore. I just like to open up to the floor and for further discussion.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay.
I'm curious, thank you very much. It was a wonderful talk and your great comments. I'm curious what happened to, in the late 80s and early 90s, proponents of ecological modernization theory held out risk as the way in which that kind of slow, future-oriented temporality might be mobilized.
Right.
Could you talk a bit about what happened to risk?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was some utopianism about how easy it was going to be to mobilize around risk. And I think some of those theorists or activists, and certainly not all of them, but certainly a large number of them, perceived risk and the outsourcing of costs and risks in general in rather homogeneous terms. And to come back to David's point about the different cultures of environmental time, I think particularly among poor communities, particularly among the Global South, there was a great suspicion about modernization theory, including theories about risk. And that was a time, particularly in say, the 80s, when for many in the Global South, the discourse of environmentalism was something that was not connected to their own environmental practices. And I think here of a part of an analogy, you say, with feminism going back to the 70s, and you would have a writer like Bessie Head, the South African refugee writer living in Botswana, whose works are now taught in women's studies classes around the world as examples of feminist writing, who was quite virulently anti-feminist because she didn't recognize herself and the village gender and sexuality dynamics in the dominant modes of feminism. And I think one of the great things about working in eco-criticism and environmental activism at this moment is that there has been a great diversification of genealogies, and I mean you're involved in this yourself, of what constitutes environmentalism, including acknowledging, say, that tree hugging wasn't something that originated solely in the redwoods of California and wasn't something restricted to white, middle class, hippie like people, but had a long history in the Chipko movement in India and in Kalimantan in Indonesia when they were fighting to preserve their forests intergenerationally. They mobilized Chipko tree-hugging strategies and so forth. So I think that the dispersal of genealogies has helped us in this moment incorporate a greater variety of environmentalisms of the poor that were not necessarily so foregrounded, at least in the field, in the environmental humanities and social sciences, at the time when risk theory and modernization was coming to the fore. I think it's a little different now.
Farming and the dining halls started collaborating with local farmers, so it's supposed to be, you know, one of the most environmentally aware areas in the country, supposedly. And I talked to 30 of my students about genetically modified foods and, you know, the fast food culture and chain restaurant, and almost all of them had no idea what I was talking about and had no idea why genetically modified foods are even bad for you, or what's wrong with McDonald's, or what's wrong with, you know, the chain food. So my question is more like a a teacher, and I'm wondering what strategies you found the most effective as a teacher to, you know, deliver the message that you deliver and to make people aware and make people feel like it matters.
Well, it's a wonderfully worldly moment in which to be teaching, and both with my environmentalist hat on and my post-colonialist hat on, I feel very animated by the reciprocity of the teaching process, particularly at this moment when students are just hungering for thinking and texts that feel worldly and consequential for them. And so I also teach at a school with a long history of environmental studies, some of it more traditional, and some of it very much connected to the Ag School, as in Massachusetts. What I teach, trying to do is, I've just been teaching a graduate seminar on world literatures of environmental justice, and trying to draw out not so much homogeneous narratives from them, but different environmental resonances, some of which overlap and some of which don't, but to most of all broaden their spectrum of what counts as environmentalism. Because a lot of, say, global studies students, who may be more traditional area study students, are a little skeptical of an idea of environmentalism. But I also find that perhaps of all the political issues, my students, undergraduates and graduates, are most connected to environmental concerns. Perhaps because of this, their total understanding, as with Social Security as well, of the burdensome legacy that they are approaching. So that's one thing. To give an example of a book that I've taught with and has really both stirred students and created a lot of debate is a book called Palestinian Walks by Reza Shehadeh. And he is a Palestinian who had lived near Ramallah, I think, for 30 years and had taken these walks through the hills. And it's describing different walks he undertook with different people at different times. And the walks are a release, or a physical connection to his land, to the land, and a release from the pressures of being a lawyer who is trying to defend Palestinian land claims in court. But he cannot separate the two out because more and more places there are barriers and fences, and he remembers when he could access the place that is now barred to him. And he recounts, for instance, an area that will be declared by the Israeli government a nature reserve, and then a short while afterwards will be declared a military zone and inaccessible to Palestinians. And that was part of his daily or weekly walk. He also encounters a particular thistle over and over again. And he remembers this thistle from the narratives in his law court. Because when this thistle, photographs of the thistle appear, it has been used very often by Israeli defendants and lawyers as evidence that this land has been neglected, that it has gone to waste because the thistles have taken over. Now the thistles aren't alien, they're indigenous. Okay, but if an olive grove has thistles in it, then the thistle is mobilized into narratives of land claim. Okay, so that's an example of the kind of book that I think can bring to life the socio-environmental consequences through a memoir of the contestatory field of what counts as environmental.
Thank you very much for your talk and for the response as well. I was thinking, as you were talking, about the problem of the Chernobyl sarcophagus that I've been reading about. Now, this sarcophagus was placed over the reactor, I guess it was about 25 years ago, and it was designed at the time to last for 30 years, which I guess was considered, you know,
a long time.
Three decades, a long time.
Yeah.
And now it's crumbling. It's been completely neglected. We have maybe, I think, 5 years of life left in it, if that much. And I've been shocked, you know, when I read the articles, you know, that have been in the news about it. So I immediately start Googling, looking it up, and seeing what people are saying about it, how this is going to be remedied. And I've been surprised that I really, and this is already some, you know, months ago, so I can't say that there hasn't been any response, you know, since then. But there was very little response from the major environmental groups, the major world environmental groups have nothing to say about it. I Googled the two of them together, I can't find anything. We have the collapse of the Soviet Empire since Chernobyl. It seems like there's just no oversight, there's nothing, there's no macro structure. And talk about an imminent problem. I mean, now we've got 4 or 5 years, what are we going to do? How even geopolitically is this going to be addressed?
Yeah. Right. No, I think that's a classic case of what seemed like long-term thinking being short-term thinking, and if there are not, there don't seem to be immediate risks to people or oil at stake or whatever. It gets sidelined, and it seems like Russia's not that interested either in their legacy. And just as we've seen with the way Texaco mutated into Chevron, the way in India with the Bhopal disaster, Union Carbide disappeared and, you know, was absorbed into Dow. Some of the mutation of political bodies, whether it's empires or corporations, and the disowning of those legacies is a really, really critical issue. And there's a wonderful book by Adriana Petrina, who's an anthropologist, about the impact of the Chernobyl disaster on the biopolitics of Ukrainians, because shortly after the disaster, as you know, Ukraine became independent, but it was not environmentally independent because it was pursued by the environmental legacy of the Chernobyl disaster. And so what you had was, instead of toxins just crossing the border, say into Belarus, you had the border crossing the toxins, you know. I think that this is a classic example of where we need both environmental groups, engineers, and people across borders to mobilize around that, the legacy of that, and to try to find those interest groups that can, you know, help cap the problem to whatever extent it can happen. Yes.
Think about if you can elaborate a little bit more on the legal possibilities and potential of slow violence, because as opposed to telling a process as a rupture that can may mobilize in terms of preventing something, this seems to be a better narrative for actually trying to deal with a problem legalistically.
Mm-hmm.
It provides a narrative often, I guess, for concerns that maybe this means as paranoia. You are thinking that you're going to get sick in 4 years, 5 years, there is no scientific, and paranoia, hysteria, whatever, is usually also very gender biased, this kind of struggle. But also from the other end, the slow violence offers a narrative that may be more useful in legal areas, but also then poses its own challenges for how to keep the struggle.
Right.
It has to be planned also, or have to find a way of fed itself intergenerationally. I can imagine a mother concerned with the cancer of her 15-year-old daughter willing to take a settlement, take the money and forget about the struggle,
right,
because her responsibility is the child,
right,
not So it's attrition that yes. fighting within the slow motion, the slow violence narrative, it also brings attrition to the struggle.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There are no easy solutions, but there are, as David pointed out, many communities, particularly what Ram Guha calls ecosystem peoples, for whom the ecosystem, whether it's a forest or wetland or grassland, is a numinous place of connection, both to the deceased and to those to come. And so it is not—it's not simply a resource to be extracted and consumed in the maximum time in the way of official, governmental, or corporate landscapes, you know. And I think that weak as those groups often are, I think the commonality and the energy that they muster is often related to the sense of it as an intergenerational place that is inhabited in ways that in much of the Western world we don't inform place typically to the same degree, with the same degree of time. Okay, the struggles are going to be protracted. What is interesting at the moment is the reconfiguration of forces, the realignment of forces. And just to take a sort of concrete example. There's a British commodities giant called Trafigura that had a ship full of really toxic slurry that they were trying to deposit in Amsterdam, and it was rejected. And it moved on to Cote d'Ivoire, and the city dump outside Abidjan. Okay. And they poured all of this stuff in there, and something like 110,000 people were severely sickened by it. Now, there was a scientific report done on this, but in a quite extraordinary measure, the British Parliament put what they call a super ban or something on even reporting of the parliamentary debate about the science. And then WikiLeaks revealed some cables, and those cables were absolutely decisive in sealing the case and ultimately the company coughing up damages, which are never adequate, but it was a significant victory anyway. What's important there is this wasn't just some magical digital intervention, but there had been grassroots groups documenting and filming in Abidjan itself. So it was Julia Lassange and the environmentalism of the poor were both part of the struggle, and lawyers in London and so forth. So it was multifaceted. But I think the world of privacy and secrecy has shifted digitally as well, and people are being exposed. There was the settlement that Shell made with the Delta peoples, the settlement in Ecuador. Some of these settlements are beginning to emerge and are resonating with each other, and I think encouraging people.
I wanted to ask a question about the conceptual structure of your argument. I was really intrigued by this move, which I find really, really interesting, to say, okay, we've found ways of thinking about the geographical externalization of costs, but what about the temporal mm-hmm. externalization? Mm-hmm. And I found myself wondering over the course of your talk, whether when one does this, and especially sort of over the longer term, whether the connection with economic stratification gets weakened. And I mean, Chernobyl is a good example.
Yep.
The long-term victims of Chernobyl are not necessarily just the poor. And in your examples, I mean, there were some examples where it is clearly the poor. In other cases, like the Maldives, I mean, that's everybody on the Maldives, affluent and poor. Niger Delta probably is a pretty clear example of the poor. The soldier example not sure, you know, that's more ambiguous. So in other words, and I mean, when we get to talk about nuclear questions, you know, and the really long term, it's totally unclear who the affected people are going to be. So in other words, by considering violence in this sort of long-term temporal perspective, do we actually weaken the connection with the sort of socioeconomic argument that is very strongly connected to the sort of geospatial approach that a lot of cultural geographers have taken to environmental issues?
In broad terms, I would say that we're all downwinders now, some sooner than others. And I think it depends very much on the scale and duration of the threat. So as you say, I mean, in the case of Chernobyl, there were certain wind patterns, and ironically, the most acutely affected people were the people of Belarus, not people in Ukraine. But there were whole swathes of Europe that were not affected. I remember hiking in Wales at the time, and the sheep were painted because of the wind pattern, and these were sheep that could not be eaten. Okay.
Sorry? In Germany, we weren't supposed to go into the parks because that was fall out of the grass.
Yeah. So it does depend very much on the character of the threat. For instance, with the flaring of gas and the oil spillages in a place like the Niger Delta, where you have historically subsistence people, ecosystem people living off fish and the land, there is an assumed sense on the part of those people that they will be there for many generations, and that they have an investment in that space. Similarly with the fisher folk in the west of Ireland, and that's why they identified very much. They realized that the fate of their waters was the fate of their community. Once you get to nuclear threats and so forth, you can appeal to a specific group of people, in this case, say, in Nevada, and what's the threat to us? But you can also make larger and larger appeals. And I think part of the challenge, particularly around climate change, has been how to make the appeals transnational and planetary, while also giving them a local texture, whether it's Bangladesh or Niger or the Maldives. These are primarily poor people who are recognizing that the conditions for their survival are becoming more marginal, and are recognizing global climate change, to which they contribute very little, as a factor. So I think you take it problem by problem. And I think the question of how invested a particular community is in two generations, centuries, even millennia from now, will vary accordingly.
Thanks to Professor Nixon and to Professor Hughes. One last question.
Just
quickly.
Okay. You mentioned the memoir. So yeah. My question is, what other ways all this perspective can be expressed? I know that the documentaries are more creative and trying to explore this kind of perspective that before you cannot see. Also the digital technologies, low budget. So how you see the perspectives of expressing these problems through art, through ways of expression?
Well, it obviously encompasses all genres from, as we were talking last night, documentary, YouTube, mini films, and then slower films like Crude that take time to amass and then may be used at a critical juncture. Even in the case of the Maldives, the video and the images, there's a sense of theatre, there's a sense of humour there, as well as desperation. And so there's a theatre of the absurd there. And so part of it, the challenge, of course, is to not always and only be ethically serious, but to find other forms of engagement. And I think Indra Sena's novel, Animals People, is a classic, a little picaresque novel about the Bhopal disaster. It's a classic example of that. It's actually a very entertaining read, improbably given the character of the subject.
Thanks so much. I think we're going to take our break. Our next event will start at 11.